thanks everybody for making it. Maybe in a couple minutes we might want to shut that door just in case it gets a bit noisy, but glad you guys all came to be a part of this. I want to talk a little bit about this matter of marriage as a moral advance, but I want to do it in the context of this pastor's conference that we've been talking about a little bit. We did one of these last year on the topic of pastor theologian. We call them Every Thought Captive Pastor's Conferences. The one that we have coming up on June 15th is on the matter of human sexuality. So our speakers, many of them are quite adept at talking about matters of human sexuality and gender identity. So we're quite excited about that. If you didn't get one of these, it's got a list of our speakers on the back as well. Some names that you might even recognize. I mentioned this just briefly last time. Glenn Stanton, who's a writer, a national speaker on this issue, does it quite well, actually. He's going to be a part of this. And then Ryan T. Anderson, who's been very busy for several years. He's very much an Orthodox Christian in the public square, works with several think tanks, has been dealing with the legal and cultural aspects of this. So it's been very exciting to secure a couple of these speakers for that day. I mentioned also yesterday that it was exciting to learn that Focus on the Family has volunteered to sponsor this event. I think, like a lot of us, there are a lot of Christian organizations out there that are realizing, all right, this conversation is happening. Things are changing fairly quickly. Are we as a Protestant, evangelical, and Pentecostal church ready to actually start dealing with these things? Thinking through the larger issues, but then thinking through the pastoral issues, thinking through the conversational issues that we have. Oftentimes, I've had a couple of them now just in the foyer of my church, in my neighborhood with friends, and you're just left going, we have to figure out how to do this. How to think through it well, how to talk through it well in a compassionate and loving kind of way. So this is why we're doing this, is gather the resources. If you're actually not able to come and be a part of it, we're also working on the technology for live streaming. We just want as many people as possible involved in this conversation. We mentioned this as well last time. If you sign up by May 1st, it's $35 instead of $45. So that's just a little carrot to get you guys. Unless you don't like carrots, it's a ding-dong to get you guys to... I don't like carrots. Okay, come and be a part of this. Sign up early. It's going to be, I think, a really good and informative day. And we're just kind of looking forward to our time together for that. All right. So I want to talk about marriage as a moral advance. A couple of my big ideas here. So by and large, what I'm going to try to do this morning is handle some of the biblical issues, the biblical case, deal with some Old Testament stuff, some New Testament and early church stuff. When you dig into the life of the early church and how the early church formed and shaped the fall of the Roman Empire and the emerging civilization, it really gets interesting. And it's really a powerful thing for you and me to see in a world that is choosing the Roman way of debauchery more and more and more. The church can actually be a very powerful and culture-changing kind of thing. And then also start dealing with some of the moral arguments and issues, but then touch on some of the research and the data and sort of discover that the science and the research is in favor of God's design for marriage and family. And we really don't have anything to be worried about biblically or historically. Or scientifically or philosophically with this issue. So, some of my big ideas: where God's design for human sexuality is lived, it's a moral advance for men, women, children, and society. It's good for everyone involved. So every time the church does this and does this well, it's a moral advance. It's good for people. The church has every good reason to hold to and to lovingly promote God's design. I think all of us feel this sometimes, and we certainly watch it happen with other churches and denominations and Christian traditions. The pressures to change the church orthodoxy on these issues just grows and grows and grows. And sometimes some of those denominations fall to that pressure. But I believe the case is very strong that the Church of Jesus Christ has every good reason to hold to God's design and to promote it well and to promote it lovingly. And then our goal, my goal inside of this talk and inside of our conference, is to help pastors find clarity and compassion and courage on this sensitive issue. because of the political wherewithal that comes along with this issue, it's very easy for us to lose sight of the compassion and the love side of things. And so we just have to be careful on both ends of that equation, I think, in a lot of ways. When I say marriage is a moral advance, I want to talk very quickly about what I mean by a moral advance. This kind of conversation, I think, is important for us because the younger an individual is, the more likely their definition of what is moral or what is morality or where a moral standard comes from, the more likely their answer is going to be different than someone on the other side of the generational scale. So biblically, theologically, as Christians, what do we mean by something is an actual moral advance? When we call something a moral standard, it's a standard because it's something that imposes itself from the outside of culture, imposes itself from the outside of the human individual's decisions and desires and wants and so forth, and it's rather rigid and unbending. C.S. Lewis has a lot of wonderful things to say about this aspect of the moral rule. It just doesn't change. We don't like that, but it doesn't change. But this is what we mean by a standard. That's why it's actually a standard. It's moral because it's inherently good. It just has this characteristic to it. It is what is good. So when we talk as Christians about what is morally good, we begin talking about things like the character and the nature of God, God's designed plan, the way He put creation together. So we're talking from, if you want to put it in these terms, sort of a top-down way of looking at morality rather than a bottom-up way of looking at morality. So what do we think is morally right? That's a little bit more of a bottom-up way of looking at things. It's moral because it is inherently of its own nature good. And it's an advance because it moves people in the direction of what is good. God's design, God's character, God's nature, God's love, God's truth, these kinds of things. Our culture loves to talk in terms of being morally progressive. That kind of phrase is used fairly often. But when you think about what it means to be morally progressive, there's no such thing as progression unless there is a standard to which you can progress or we see people falling away from, right? If there isn't that kind of external moral standard that's out there that we can all talk about somehow, moral progression just means change. It takes a little bit of time to flesh it out, but without the standard, we're talking about moral change, and there's no difference between better or worse when that morality changes. It just changes. Right? If we're not moving toward a standard or away, we don't have that sense of it's better or worse. So we as followers of Jesus Christ, we see things through the lens of the standard of God's character and creation and so forth. And so we can talk in terms of what's a moral advance or even a moral retreat. I want to talk a little bit about the Old Testament pattern. And I want to talk about this for a couple of minutes because the Old Testament pattern is sometimes the difficult pattern for us to deal with. We've got a couple of good friends, been Christians for a very long time. Every now and then they'll talk to me about Scripture and so forth, and they've said stuff like this: I really wish the book of Deuteronomy was not in the Bible. Because you read what Deuteronomy has to say, and obviously other books of the Old Testament are a little bit difficult this way sometimes, but Deuteronomy collects a lot of the Old Testament laws, many of them on marriage, male-female relationships, parent-child relationships, human sexuality. And to our ears, sometimes those things sound a little bit odd and a little bit interesting. So when we deal with the Old Testament pattern on the matter of human sexuality and marriage, I think there are a couple of lenses that we can use that help us actually walk through the Old Testament rather than sort of being embarrassed of it or frustrated by it. So the Old Testament very quickly sets the standard for us, right? God sets up the very first institution that God uses to build the rest of the human race is marriage and family. The state is not primary for God. Family and marriage and human sexuality and how that works, that's the foundational institution as far as God is concerned. That's what He sets up to build the rest of it. But human sin very quickly breaks the pattern. Our very first polygamist is our second murderer, Lamech. I mean, this happens very quickly inside of the biblical narrative. So God sets a standard, a design. Human sin very quickly breaks it. And so when we begin to read Old Testament laws about human sexuality and so forth, I think it's very useful to keep that tension in mind, that God has set a standard, a design, that is written in His Word. His people know it, even if they forget it. It's in God's law, right? But then you've got human sin. So you've got this tension. So God is dealing with these things constantly with His people, drawing them closer and closer, or trying to draw them closer to His design and how He put things together. I gave you some very readable text there in your little handouts. These are just a few things from... That's a joke, by the way. I know most of you can't read that text. A sampling from some of the things that are actually in Deuteronomy. Some of them are a little bit easier to sort of tease out. Some of them are a little bit more difficult to tease out. One of my favorites here is Deuteronomy 22, verse 5. Women shall not wear men's clothes, and men shall not wear women's clothes, for it is an abomination to the Lord. Now, in times past, what that meant was, if you're female, don't wear pants, right? That's sometimes how that is often taken. In the context of the book of Deuteronomy, and the people of God making their way into the promised land that's full of Canaanites and Canaanite religion, here's the context of that verse. A very common Canaanite occultic prostitution practice was transvestism. So the men and women who were involved in occultic prostitution would often blur the lines between male and female. So not just the clothing side of things, but the human sexuality side of things in those pagan religions were being deliberately blurred in matters of worship, as a matter of fact. So the more you learn about what the people of God were dealing with, or trying to overcome, or being asked to conquer, or being told over and over again, don't marry into that, right? That's not racism, that's not xenophobia, that's don't marry into that. Because it's a regression away from God's standards, right? So there's a way of walking through the Old Testament to understand why God is giving us these laws. And it begins, I think, to bring to light a little bit more of our theology, what we hold to, and what we think about some of these Old Testament passages. Another one of my favorites is in Deuteronomy 25, verses 9 and 10. This is actually part of the Levirate matter of laws. And so if a close relative refuses to marry a widow and raise up children for the rest of that family, she had the legal right. And the moment in the Old Testament world you say she had the legal right, you're talking about a moral advance, because that's going to be incredibly rare inside of that world. But she had the moral right to shame the man. And this is where the practice of taking off a sandal comes from. That becomes part of the book of Ruth a little bit later on, is part of the woman's legal right when it comes to marriage and children and economics, as a matter of fact, as well. So we've got God's design, we've got human sin that's done some crazy things with that. So all along the way, these laws that sometimes seem odd or bizarre to us, God is drawing His people closer and closer to His design, right? So it's not something for us to be, afraid of. The New Testament and the early church. So I just kind of quickly want to slide into a little bit of this. In the New Testament, injunctions regarding eldership, widows, marriage, and self-control, we begin to comprehend the kind of background upon which they were given. One of my favorite examples of this kind of thing, and you know, as we're familiar with the New Testament, I think we can imagine several of these kinds of examples. But when Paul writes to the young pastor Titus, Titus is on this island of Crete, and Paul tells us in the book of Titus that Cretans are Cretans. It's just bad news there. And it turns out that that very Greco-Roman culture was a very debauched culture. It was a very broken culture. The family structure was broken. Male patriarchy and dominance, not just economically, but sexually and socially as well, was rampant on the island of Crete. And so now you've got this young pastor, and Paul is telling him, I want the elders of your church to be like this. This is not just some form of Puritanism. He's saying, I want the leaders in your church to no longer be a part of that culture. So they have to be the husband of one wife. I don't want these people being drunkards, because they used to be drunkards, and culture is a drunkard culture, right? So all these kinds of things that sometimes as pastors we walk through in Bible studies and sermons that, you know, sometimes may feel weird and odd to us, were this profound matter of difference between the church and Titus and the eldership from the world that they had come out of. You're going to have to look different. You're going to have to behave different. In fact, Paul tells Titus inside of that book, and as you behave differently, God will be glorified, and the world will see it. And when they accuse you of X, Y, and Z, it will all be false because you've walked out of a certain kind of lifestyle. So when we watch that happen in the New Testament, we're actually catching a glimpse into what the church was working against, to what a lot of these brand new believers were coming out of. So now their notion of what marriage is changing. How I raise my kids, why I raise my kids, why I don't expose my daughter and essentially abort her after she's born. All of this is changing, right? Because of what's happening inside of the New Testament. So the Christian ethic that's harkening back to God's created order, it changed the Roman world. I know that sounds dramatic, but if you spend time with this issue and people who write well on this issue, you will find that this is profoundly true. It changed the Roman world and gave us the set of assumptions the West has worked on for a very long time. For better or for worse, whether we do it well or we don't do it well, the set of assumptions that the Christian Western world has had about marriage and family and human sexuality for a very long time did not come out of the Roman world. It came out of the Christianization of the Roman world. So as that debauchery fell apart and the Christian, the Christian influence came, it really changed things in some pretty powerful ways. And here are just a handful of examples and thoughts when it comes to human sexuality and what the Christian church has done and what it did, especially as the early church was living out what they had learned from the apostles and from Christ. So the Christian ethic infused marriage and human sexuality with a moral and divine meaning. So it's wrapped up inside of what we believe about God. It's wrapped up in what we believe about His covenant with us, how He built us. So it infuses these things with divine and moral meaning. Again, this moral thing coming from the top down, telling us who we are and how best we work and live and flourish, instead of coming from the bottom up and being something entirely different. So the two become one flesh, turning the sexual act into expression of mutual love, commitment, and procreation instead of self-serving lust and physical gratification. I've got a couple of books here inside of the resources there that actually draw out this argument in great detail. And they're fascinating, fascinating works. So the Christian church is teaching us stuff like the love between husband and wife reflects the love and the commitment between God and His people, becoming a covenant that mirrors God's covenant with us. So these are all things that are happening inside of the Christian church because of Christian theology and the way that we're trying to put our families and marriages together. All of this is being infused into this matter of marriage and of human sexuality. It wasn't there before. So children are raised in this atmosphere, creating the best conditions for their physical, emotional, and spiritual health. So marriage is morally forming for kids. It just is. And this is one of the this is one of the ways in which we can talk about the matter of same-sex marriage as well, is how are children being morally formed with a different kind of psychological and physical and moral influence in their lives as opposed to the male-female influence inside of their lives. So marriage is morally forming for kids. And as we'll find out, marriage is actually a very safe and healthy place for children as well. This kind of thing, combined with the doctrine of the Imago Dei, created an atmosphere where women went from non-citizens and subhuman to full members of family and religious life, and over time, eventually, society as well. How many of you have read anything by Rodney Stark? Rodney Stark is a fascinating author. He's a sociologist. He writes on the history of religion, primarily on the history of the early Christian church. The early Christian church making its way up to the Reformation and so forth. I think for a very long time, he wasn't a deist, he wasn't a theist, he just kind of saw things in this really interesting way. I believe it's recently become a theist, but he has written book after book after book with titles like this, The Triumph of Christianity. And by and large, it's this story of how the way Christians saw things and did things and lived things out transformed society. And what we've received, what we've assumed for a long time, comes from our Christian ancestors, not from our Roman ancestors. Not even necessarily from the Renaissance as much as it is from the Christian influence inside of these things. So he has some pretty powerful things that he writes about. And The Triumph of Christianity is a wonderful book. Women were especially drawn to Christianity because it offered them a life that was so greatly superior to the life they otherwise would have led. And he says in that little section inside of that book, the life in the Christian world for the woman was better from cradle to grave. Inside of a Christian home, far less likely to actually be exposed as an infant because Roman families didn't want daughters. They wanted sons through the rest of the course of her life. By the way, did you know that in the Roman world, most people did not receive funerals? Only if you were powerful and wealthy would you have a funeral and memorial service. And so it's an early Christian bishop by the name of Lactantius who says, we're going to start performing funerals for everybody, because everybody is created in the image of God. We're not going to let anybody go without paying attention to them. So even just the matter of having funerals for everybody, again, it's not a Roman thing. It's a Christian thing, right? So we've got all this moral advance built inside of our theology. And I believe, guys, and I don't want to be hyper-dramatic here, but I believe that our culture might be back on another one of these tipping points, where it might be sliding back into a little bit more of a Roman way of seeing things. And so where is the Christian church going to stand, and what is the Christian church going to do, right? One of the distinctive markers of Christian religion as compared to Roman religion was the belief that Christians were morally obligated to their God. It seems a little bit odd to us to make a point like this, because we've assumed on one level or another that our faith, our religion, is somehow inherently moral. It's tied to what we do and how we behave. It's just inherently moral. Well, Larry Hurtado, who's a historian and a New Testament theologian, New Testament critic in a good way, wrote this book recently called The Destroyer of the Gods. And what he means by this is how Christianity destroyed the Roman pagan world and gave us the world that we have today. And he builds this case that was just fascinating to read. That for the most part, the Roman religious world, the Romans' relationship with their God was transactional and it was functional. If you needed rain and good crops, you would go through the system of sacrifices. If you needed children to farm your land, you'd go through the system of sacrifices for that God. So it's very transactional and functional. One of the things the Christian world brings into the realm of religion and faith is this moral attachment between their God and themselves. Again, we take that for granted, but that was brand new inside of their world. So here's part of what he says. The Greek term early Christians preferred, however, to depict their God's love and the love that they were to show as well for God and others, even their enemies, was agape in its cognate verb agapeo, emphasizing a moral commitment to the one loved. These terms also had the effect of marking off early Christian discourse about their God from pagan discourse about the other deities of the time. So just made the way we talked about God differently. It makes the way we talk about things, even like human sexuality, marriage, and kids, different than what the early Christian church was having to deal with. So here's what I think is some of the punchline of this portion here. The Christian view taught in the New Testament and lived out in the early church was radically different. Because of its moral advantages, it raised the lives of those who followed the standard. Eventually, the Christian view outlived the Roman Empire and its debauchery. So, which do we choose now? Which path do we go? So, what we have for the world is the same thing our ancestors had for the world 1900, 1800 years ago, is this moral advance of how God built us to flourish and to live, even as our world makes some very different decisions. All right, I want to talk a little bit about what the science and just matters of reason teach us. So we hear this a lot in one form or another. The pro-argument for the broadening of the morality of human sexuality and living out of human sexuality, the broadening of the definition of marriage and things like that, it often fits a form that's a little bit like this. if we want to be compassionate, if we want to show love, and we want folks like this who have these kinds of desires to do better, we will let people pursue a different sexuality or change their identity. We may even actually provide a path for them to do that if we want to show compassion and be loving. Or we'll support them at the very least as they pursue this change of identity. So it's wrapped up in these moral terms. If we want to be compassionate, here's what we're going to want to do. If we want to show love, here's how we want to do it. And if we're really going to be compassionate, we're going to throw federal dollars at it or state dollars at it. So it's always wrapped up in these kinds of moral terms, right? So this is often the moral argument that our culture has just decided to make. What is moral is a matter of what I desire. You can kind of fill out that word desire however you want to, but it's the equation of what I desire, what I feel I desire, with what is moral. Now, this is the kind of thing I think that helps us get a grasp on some of the conflicts, some rather heated conflicts inside of our culture and in these conversations, right? These conversations are hard because they immediately touch on some pretty sensitive and personal things. But especially if individuals or large swaths of our culture have made this kind of moral decision, what it means is this: disagreement is hate, right? So, because if I disagree with you and you have defined the moral good as what you desire, then I have immediately disagreed with who you are. As opposed to being able to talk about the thing itself or the decision itself, we are now in a situation with a lot of these conversations where we immediately hit kind of the very core of people. And, you know, we don't say that to be demeaning, but just to understand why sometimes it kind of comes across this way, right? That disagreement is hate. But what we discover when we talk about moral issues is that when we choose what is moral, this is good for us, and the human actually flourishes. If we violate the moral choice, we find human breakdown and struggle. So, a question that lies before us that we have to at least be able to think through as we deal with these issues: does the transgender choice, does the broadening of human sexuality lead to flourishing or to breakdown? And it might help us, figure out, is this what's actually good for the human being or not? So here's what some of the science and matters of reasoning teach us about issues of transgenderism. And here's just a few details, many of which, if you track this down, these details are actually fairly common in the literature. A lot of this is cited in Ryan Anderson's book, When Harry Became Sally. That book is a year old, at tops, maybe 6 months?
3 months.
3 months old. So this is all fresh and brand new stuff he's collected and cited the sources and all that good stuff. Post-op transsexuals report lower satisfaction with their general quality of health and with some of the new physical limitations placed on them because of the surgery, as opposed to a renewed sense of this is who I am and I feel better about what I can do and who I am. They report lower levels of satisfaction, especially after a gender change surgery. Rate of psychiatric hospitalization for post-op transsexuals is about 3 times the rates of a control group, of control groups. Risk of mortality from all causes is significantly higher. This one was interesting to me. I didn't expect this. Rate of criminal conviction was significantly higher. And these last two are really interesting. So suicide attempts are nearly 5 times higher. And this is stunning. Likelihood of actually dying from suicide was about 19 times higher in transgender, both pre- and post-op transgender transsexual individuals. Now, these kinds of stats, they deserve some thought and they deserve some work, because oftentimes my counselor friends and psychologist friends will tell me folks who fall into this group often already come with a set of psychological complications in their life already, and they might already be leaning towards suicidality to begin with, believing that maybe some of these identity changes or physical changes will help them through the process. And it turns out that it doesn't help them through the process. It becomes even more difficult for them. Oftentimes when people argue with stats like these suicide rates, what they'll say is this, is, well, these suicide rates are higher like this because they're not accepted by culture. And so as culture, we need to be better at accepting them, and then we'll reduce those rates. Now, part of what's interesting with that is that we have a couple of cultures in Europe that are about a generation ahead of us on this scale. And some of these cultures, the Netherlands and some other places, as cultures, are far more accepting of same-sex marriage and transgender issues and all these kinds of things. And the suicide rates are the same in those locations as they would be in the United States and in Canada as well. So you can't necessarily say if we accepted them more, these rates would go down. But here's part of what strikes me. We always have to be careful, right? But here's part of what strikes me. If we just blanked out that word and we gave those two stats, who would say, let's do it, right? And yet we find ourselves again in this cultural moment where there's just this heat that's been built up over this issue. So as Christians, we step back, we try to think clearly, and we try to love clearly and compassionately and well. And again, part of what I'm thinking through is that what God has given us in our theology and our way of life is, in fact, the compassionate, loving thing. So then we communicate it that way, right, as well as we possibly can. I think that's really important stuff. So the transgenderism is very fresh. The matter of same-sex marriage is also a matter of a lot of interaction and debate. So in Ryan Anderson's book, Truth Over Rule, which he wrote just after the Obergefell decision, it's about same-sex marriage and a lot of the data and legal issues involved with that. Studies that control for other factors, including poverty, even genetics, suggest that children reared in intact homes do best in measurements of educational achievement, emotional health, familial and sexual development, and delinquency and incarceration. It's just all across the board. Children just do better, right, when marriage is shaped the way that God wants it to be shaped. The depression rates of young adult children in same-sex marriages is about 51% compared to 20% for those raised in traditional marriage. Obesity rates, which again I did not expect, 72% for those kids raised in same-sex marriage versus 31% for traditional marriage. So then I give you guys, this comes from Mark Regnerus, who writes on this sometimes, the data on children in same-sex households gets more depressing. And it's in... it's in that resource page that I gave you that none of you can read, but I promise you it's there. But this is quite something. So this is a measurement of a lot of these data points. And if we go back to our question of if we're making the good moral choice in human matters of human sexuality and marriage and child rearing, is the human being flourishing? Or if we make another choice, is the human being not flourishing, right? And so we see a lot of not flourishing going on in some of these data points. And it's hard, it's difficult. And again, we have a lot of this because some of these European cultures are about a generation ahead of us on this. So this is not, you know, 6 months worth of data. This is fairly longitudinal data, some of them actually are. So here's a quick and dirty way to think about this. I borrow some of this terminology from Dallas Willard. What I desire to do is not always the good thing to do. If you've worked with teenagers, this just strikes you as true. I know you want to do that, but that's a dumb thing to do, right? Raising kids. We just know these things. What I desire is not always the good thing for me to do. Now, if we can, in a nutshell, describe Christian love as something like, to love someone is to desire their good, then that leads us to a point as a Christian church where sometimes what it means to show someone compassion in love is to advocate for something that's different than what they desire. Does that make sense? Yeah. It's just kind of this train of thought. And again, it's a matter of compassion and love, but thoughtfulness and truth as well. We let go of truth, and you know, things are just going to kind of fall off the handle. If we let go of love, it's just going to be angry shouting at each other. So we can't do either one of those things. So the faithful Christian church is going to strive to find ways to love and show compassion and truth. And I believe, guys, and again, I'm not trying to be hyper-dramatic, but I do believe that in the Western culture, the faithful church is just going to show the way. And the faithful church is just going to kind of endure. We're going to try to figure these things out in a loving and a truthful fashion. And on the other side, the faithful Christian church will still be there, right? I've read this a couple of times, and I think this is absolutely right, that probably in the next generation or so, the Christian church has to be prepared for a refugee crisis. But it's a refugee crisis from the sexual revolution. That's the refugee crisis that, you know, some of our churches need to be prepared for. We have to be faithful and thoughtful and loving through these things. Got just a couple of minutes. They told me I had until 2 o'clock. No, I'm just kidding. Again, I'm just kidding. You guys can... you can't read some of this probably, so let me just talk about some of these resources. There's one of them that I forgot to stick on your sheet of paper, and I apologize for that. There was a massive research project done out of Johns Hopkins University from their lead psychiatrist and one of his assistants. It was a literature review, and they gathered together all of the literature on these issues, just scientific research and data. And the conclusions that they came to are the kinds of conclusions that we're talking to now. Just, again, Johns Hopkins University, just clearly, just not, you know, it's not a Christian thing. It was published in a journal, and you can get the whole thing online for free, the New Atlantis. So if you go to the New Atlantis website and you look up same-sex marriage, I don't know, does anybody know that guy's last name? It's killing me. But you can actually get the whole PDF there for free, download it, and you can sort through that data if you want to do that. So I apologize for not having that on the list. A couple of recent books by Ryan T. Anderson, this book by Larry Hurtado. If you're into this kind of thing, you enjoy history and watching this unfold, it's just a fascinating book. Lee Patrick, The Conjugal Union, What Marriage Is and Why It Matters, Cambridge University Press. So this is a wonderful defense and argument from... roughly, a Christian point of view, but not quoting scripture, but dealing with the science and philosophy of it. It's a wonderful book. Nancy Piercy recently wrote a book on the theology of the body. This article from Mark Regnerus I gave you inside of the notes there. A book that's actually very accessible, but is linked to a lot of bibliographic data. Alvin J. Schmidt, How Christianity Changed the World. It's a really cool book. Chapter after chapter after chapter. Chapter this is on education. This chapter is on marriage. This chapter is on women. This chapter is on children. This chapter is on the law. And he just walks through from the early Christian church to the Reformation, how Christians changed things and built the world that we have now. Very accessible, but linked to a lot of other information. Glenn Stanton's book, Loving My LGBT Neighbor. So Heather and I are reading through this book right now. Another very accessible book, and very much a Christian argument about the love and truth thing. How can we do this lovingly? How can we do this truthfully? And this is the world that he lives in. This is not academic for him. This is what he does, and he'll be speaking for us. Rodney Stark's book, The Triumph of Christianity, lots of historical data in there. Some of it dovetails with this. And then another recent book that just came out by Andrew T. Walker. Albert Mohler wrote the foreword to it. God and the Transgender Debate, What Does the Bible Actually Say About Gender Identity? The first half of this book is a very straightforward theology of the human body and human sexuality and marriage and so forth. And the second half deals specifically with questions and issues of how a church might actually interact with some of this. In fact, the last chapter is just, well, let's just say we have a couple in our church whose child has decided to go through the gender transition surgery. What should, you know, how should we talk to them? How should we walk this through with them? So it grows actually very practical by the end of it. If you've got a group of people in your church, you might want to do what you might call a Bible study on this issue. Glenn Stanton's book and Andrew Walker's book would actually be really good books to read. Very accessible, very easy to read. So there's some information. There's some stuff. Thanks for being here. I really appreciate it. I hope you guys consider coming to the conference June 15th, etc2018.org is the website. It's on that card that we gave you. Follow the Facebook page for updates and information and so forth. And thanks for coming. Appreciate it. Any thoughts? Yes, sir. Not you. Yeah. Go ahead.
One of my favorite comments I've heard is just your kind of your anecdotal story of the beginning of Sarah's Home, the committee that you sat in on this morning. You share that, because I think that's one of the one of those light bulb moments for me on this marriage and a healthy family being a moral advance.
It was for me powerfully, as a matter of fact. So several years ago, a group of us are starting Sarah's Home. Sarah's Home is designed to provide girls who've been rescued out of human trafficking with education and ministry and so on and so forth, and a residential home. So we're in the process of getting this started. And where we were in El Paso County, there was a group of social system organizations that were trying to build an extension point essentially out on the eastern plains of El Paso County. So they were gathering together all of these organizations that did social work in El Paso County for a roundtable discussion just to sort of catch up on things. And so they invited us to come be a part of that. Here's what we're doing and why we're doing it. And then I gave my spiel. I sat down, and the table probably had 15, 16 different organizations represented there. Everything from what you would think of with DHS, foster care services, adoption services, to the Pikes Peak Library District. Our library district was there because they did literature and literacy services for some of these kids, to organizations that provided food just for kids in the foster system, to organizations that handled foster kids who had special needs. I mean, almost everything you could think about was represented around that table, and they're all part of the county social services program. Everyone of our counties probably has a group of people who's a little bit like this. And very quickly, the conversation turned into, I wish we could take care of these kids that continue to slip through the system. I wish I could take care of them, but my mandate says I can't take care of this kid because of this situation, so I have to only take care of these kids. It was stunning to me. With all of those people, with great hearts and great intentions, nothing wrong with any of them. And on another level, all of that county money, right? That was being poured into all those organizations to take care of many of those kids and families as possible, it struck me in a moment that everything that was represented around that table could be solved with a healthy family. Everything. Food, education, literacy, foster, adoption, all of that could just go away because of a healthy family. And you begin to see these things, and these people were doing everything they could, right? Nothing wrong with any of them. But here we are as the Christian church saying, here's the way. Here's the way to go. And there's no good reason to drop it, I don't think. So it was. It was a powerful light bulb moment for me as well. Yes, sir.
You know, as a church plunge headlong into this issue, you know, gender specificity is something that I think we really need to go forward with as a foundation. Because we're gender confused. As we see the life cycles of denominations, that life cycle, we tend to reflect the culture and go forward with a foundation of compassion with truth, if applicable. But if we want to hang in there and stay strong, we need to have the foundation of truth with compassion. And there's a difference of emphasis there. God has expressed himself to us in complete gender specificity, and a good study for all of us, it would do us well to really study how God has designed so much of what we know with gender specificity, even as, you know, the Son of God, Son of Man, you know, Holy Spirit being me, God the Father, you know, different things like that. There's a lot to study there. But I think if we would grab a hold of those concepts and the foundation, it will do us well, that we're going to be better able to stay on track and not be the proverbial frog in the kettle as we go into this.
So here's what I think is interesting about some of these kinds of cycles, is that whatever culture decides to do starts sort of placing this pressure and using this language that the church is not accustomed to sort of dealing with and responding with. Some of these books and a lot of other good resources actually line out. So when academics talk about the difference between gender and sex, what do they mean by that? Well, you know, a generation ago, 5 years ago, who knew that the church would now have to listen to that conversation and then respond with or begin to think through, so theologically, what's the best way through this? How do we want to handle this language in truth and in love and so forth? And oftentimes, this is just how it happens. Culture moves in one direction, and the church goes, oh, wait a second, we haven't thought about that as deeply as we should have yet. So then the church has to turn around and push back in that sense and just say, okay, we have to start thinking about this. And so, you know, these matters of gender and sexuality and identity and so forth, how are we in that conversation as faithful Christians walking forward, right? Maybe we didn't have to think about that 10 years ago, but we probably should have, you know, to some degree, but here we are. Here we are. Yes, sir.
So in Denver, there's a lot of, we deal with this a lot. I really appreciate the discussion. I think we run into churches that it seems like every week there are churches that are becoming open and affirming churches. And I sit down with those pastors and we talk. They've tried to bring us in and we say no. But one of the things that their objections are is not so much, they would agree with actually most of what's being said, in that pagan practices and these sort of things, debauchery, all this sort of thing, that would be wrong. But they would say that there's not a biblical context for committed same-sex relationships. And so they would take that as the moral in the family unit is the commitment. So they would say the morals that we're talking about is commitment.
It's commitment.
And they would pull out some other things, and they would say you can have those in same-sex relationships. I'd be curious what you would say to that. I know that's actually been the discussion point in Denver amongst the pastors.
Yeah.
And so the good news is we can all come to the table and talk, and we're not throwing spears at each other.
Yeah.
And half of us would say we're not going the direction you're going, and the other half say no, come be open and affirming. That's their sticking point.
Yeah.
Is that they would say yes, moral advance, but the morals we're talking about can also be expressed in same-sex relationships.
Yes. That's really interesting, right? Because, another one of the books that Anderson and some others were involved with, a philosopher by the name of John Corvino, who is one of the leading philosophers on the same-sex marriage side of things, they'll go back and forth about a lot of this. And so the position is often called the consent position. And so commitment, consent between adults and so forth, that's the moral standard for what we mean by marriage and family, as opposed to kind of everything that we walk through here. And there's where I think the Christian has learned how to be a little bit more philosophically adept than maybe sometimes we are. And taking that starting point, which is a fascinating starting point, and say, well, if these are the standards, and then starting to ask the what if question, what if, what if, what if. And it's not slippery slope, I don't think, to ask the what if question. It's just sort of a practical induction. Well, if that's the standard, then what do you mean by consenting adult? Can you give me, a definition of adult? Can you clearly define consent for me? What if three people consent? And what's interesting about questions like that is that already in serious publications, including the New York Times a few years ago, serious articles are being written by lawyers and so on and so forth, arguing for polygamy and polyamory. As soon as Obergefell happens, the in principle sort of thing begins to fall apart, and we've got a different standard that people are working with. Well, if the standard is different, well, let's fiddle with that standard some. And let's ask, well, why not polygamy? Why not a 50-year-old man and a 15-year-old girl? Why not? Right? And just not necessarily, I think you do this very well, Preston, a lot of us probably do this fairly well, not in an aggressive fashion, but just asking the question, if that's your moral standard, well, let's fiddle with it a little bit and see if we can get to a point where either you have an answer or you don't have an answer, or we're going to have to keep walking through. And that's oftentimes how people will deal with the consent view of marriage. If the in-principle things that we've been talking about are gone, then what else becomes possible? The point of asking that question is to bring somebody to a point where they're immorally uncomfortable with saying yes, that's fine. So then you hit that moral point where then you're back to okay, why not, or why or why not? And so we've hit that moral tipping point, whatever that moral tipping point is. Yeah.
Do you think it's effective in those situations like Preston outlined when you have a group of ministers or other Christians involved? And they're willing to submit somewhat to the authority of Scripture. They're committed Christians. They're going to church on Sunday. They worship Jesus, all these things. They're gleaning a lot of other moral teachings from the New Testament, from Paul, to say that, if you do believe in the God of the Bible, if you do believe that Jesus Christ is Lord, and we were designed by that God, then all of nature and our human design and our sexual complementarity is part of God's design. So it's not just about a commitment, it's not just about consent, but it's actually how God designed us. And so even if you're committed in a relationship where you're violating that natural design, you're transgressing the God that you claim to love as presented in Scripture. Do you think that's effective as well?
You know, I'm going to give a very philosopher answer. It probably depends. Right? But I think that's part of the value of us being aware of sort of the science side of things, the philosophical argumentation side of things. To say, well, in fact, it is so built into us to work in God's complementary kind of structure, even psychologically and socially, that when we break that, we have negative consequences that otherwise we wouldn't have to that same degree. And that's where I think sometimes that can come in to help the point of view, or at least our perspective. Say, well, we're not just quoting Scripture to you, but we actually have, reality is showing us that this seems to work better. So I would think in some circumstances it does. Yeah. Well, guys, got a couple hours for lunch. Time is up. There might be a few more handouts floating around. Thank you so much for taking a little bit of time here. I appreciate it. Hope to see you guys there.
Thank you.
Yeah.